This program is brought to you by RTS on iTunes U from the Distance Education Department of Reformed Theological Seminary. For more information on RTS degrees and programs, please visit us at www.rts.edu or call 1-855-854-6920.
Now, Butler's chief book is called The Analogy of Religion. That's not the whole title. This is an 18th century book, so in 18th century books you have titles that go for the whole page, The Analogy of Religion, blah, 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 blah. But most people summarize it just by calling it The Analogy or The Analogy of Religion. And what Butler is trying to show is that there is an analogy between God's revelation in nature and God's revelation in Scripture. Or there's an analogy between natural revelation and redemptive revelation. There's an analogy between the arguments that the deists accepted, arguments that God is the creator, lawgiver, and moral judge, and those things that the deists rejected, the miracles, the story of the incarnation, the atonement, the resurrection of Jesus Christ. There's an analogy between this and redemption. So, you deists, if you have problems down here, if you have problems with the miracle stories, if you have problems with the idea of atonement, there are similar problems up here. There's similar problems with natural religion, with natural revelation. Or, if you think that the arguments for natural revelation are persuasive, the arguments, there's an analogy down here. The arguments for redemption are equally persuasive. So you can't really do what the deists are trying to do. The deists are trying to accept this and reject this. Butler is saying you can't do that. Either you accept this and accept this or reject them both because the two are analogous. So that's what the book of the analogy of religion is all about. He says, we come to determine probabilities. See, this is what we're after, not absolute certainty, but probabilities. He says, we come to determine probabilities by forming analogies between the known and the unknown, and between past experience and the present and future. We also use analogy to reason from the laws of one realm to those of another. The procedure assumes that the author of nature governs all realms by essentially the same laws. Now, this is the common ground between Butler and the deists. They both believe that there is an author of nature, that there is a personal being that made the world and governs the world. So, but if that's true, then the author of nature governs everything by essentially the same laws. Now, this is an assumption made by Newtonian science, and this is plausible to people in those days. It wasn't so plausible to Hume and to Kant. Hume had questions about cause and effect, which would have appalled Newton. Kant had other kinds of questions. So it's legitimate to assume that the principles governing the natural world will, in like manner, govern man's relationship to God. Van Til called that the principle of continuity. But since we don't see the whole universe from God's point of view, and since God is beyond our complete understanding, we must expect also certain differences between the two realms. That is the principle of discontinuity. Butler wants to show the deists that there's an analogy between natural revelation, which they claim to accept, and special revelation, which they do not. The reasons for accepting special revelation are similar to and just as strong as the reasons for accepting natural revelation. The problems and mysteries of special revelation are no greater than the problems and mysteries of natural revelation. Okay, just take up one topic here, which Butler emphasized, the argument for immortality. Okay, Butler says we go on and live after we die, all right? We have an afterlife. The deists challenge that. Well, Butler says, sure, he says there's a great change that takes place in death, right? And when somebody dies, they just lie there. They don't respond. They don't move around. Well, that's a big change, but you know, there are lots of other changes that are analogous, okay? There are a lot of changes that we go through in our physical life from embryo to old age, all right? I mean, everybody starts as an embryo and a fetus and an infant and a child and an adolescent and an adult and eventually an old geezer. And there are a lot of, and the old geezer is all pretty different from the embryo, right? So that's pretty drastic change, pretty drastic set of changes. How do you know? And yet through this drastic set of changes, people still live. It's the same person, right? From embryo to geezer. How do you know that death is not just another one of those transitions? It's another form of life, but the same person persists through that change that we call death. Here's another argument. Natural things and human powers have momentum, okay? This is a scientific principle, right? When things are, there's a commercial on that keeps saying this ad nauseum, things that are in motion tend to stay in motion and things at rest tend to stay at rest. When things are moving in a certain direction at a certain speed, they tend to persist. In that motion, in that speed, in that direction. So why shouldn't we assume that the powers of life continue even after somebody's died? There's that momentum that would lead you to believe that the person is still moving, still active. You can't see it, but maybe he's somewhere else, you know. So you should suppose that that momentum continues on into the next world. Furthermore, he says, see that we're drawing analogies here. Analogies between changes in life, changes in death. Analogies between momentum in life, momentum in death. Now the powers of the self persist through apparent inactivity. You go to sleep, right? Well, sleep is a little bit like death. Some people are heavier sleepers than others. Some people are harder to wake up than others. But sleep can be a lot like death, right? But nevertheless, people do wake up from sleep, and then they go on living. Well, why can't death be like that? You know, why can't death be kind of a temporary time when the body is unresponsive, but eventually will get up and walk around, or maybe he is getting up and walking around someplace else. Or if you're in a coma, that's even more like death, isn't it? You're just lying there and not responsive at all, and you may lie there for days or weeks or months, even years. People have been in comas, and then they've gotten up again. Strange, very difficult to predict. And why can't death be like that? I mean, it's just minor matter that people in the coma are still breathing. but that's a minor thing from one point of view. Why can't we assume that death is just another thing, but it's much deeper than a coma because the person quits breathing for a while. Another argument, number four, says Butler, changes in the body do not necessarily affect our ability to think. Now, you know, today a lot of people go on drugs and it does affect their ability to think, even just getting drunk. I'm sure Butler understood that. People don't think so well when they've had too much alcohol in their system, but anyway, it's possible to undergo major bodily changes. It's possible to lose an arm and still be a perfectly good thinker. So we shouldn't assume that when the body is in bad shape and the body is injured, the mind is injured too. Rather, we should be more broad-minded than that, and we should consider the possibility that when somebody dies, his mind is still active. His soul, if you want, is still active, okay? So you see what Butler's doing. He's drawing analogies between life and death. He's drawing analogies between the changes that go on during life and the larger change that takes place in death. Well, but somebody says, wait a minute here. I mean, isn't there also an analogy between the death of the body and the death of the soul? You know, if the body is just lying there inert, why shouldn't we assume that the mind is also inert? Shouldn't we assume that the latter accompanies the former? Here, Butler invokes the principle of discontinuity. He says we don't know enough about the soul's powers to say that it expires with the body. See, here Butler is playing all these analogies, and then when somebody says, well, isn't there an analogy between the death of the soul and the death of the mind, he says, well, we just don't know enough about that. So he invokes disanalogy. He invokes analogy when it favors his conclusion, and he invokes disanalogy when that favors his conclusion. And a lot of people have disagreed with Butler there, and they've said, well, isn't that kind of arbitrary? I mean, why couldn't somebody say, well, yeah, you know, a coma is like death, but a coma is also unlike death, you know. In comas, people still breathe, and so we shouldn't assume that there's any life going on after somebody dies. And that's the way arguments about Butler's analogy go. You know, the believer says there's an analogy here. The unbeliever says, yeah, but there's also a disanalogy here. The believer says there's continuity here. Unbeliever says there's discontinuity here. Or the unbeliever says there's continuity here, and the believer says there's discontinuity here. It almost becomes kind of arbitrary. I mean, it's the whole argument loses its plausibility on either side. But at least Butler is trying, I mean, at his best, Butler is inculcating in us a certain level of intellectual humility so that we don't go off half-cocked and say, well, of course there's no life after death. He's raising questions about that. He's raising objections about that. Well, you can read some of the arguments about this. Again, Van Til doesn't like Butler because Butler focuses on probability, makes only the claim for probability. And I defend Butler as I defended Pascal on that score. But I think really Butler is not all that persuasive. And by the way, I mean, Butler's method is not all that influential in contemporary apologetics. In contemporary apologetics, you have a lot of use of evidences, and you have presuppositionalists and reformed epistemologists and so on, but you never have anything that's quite like Butler. I mean, Butler, there have been some other people who have reasoned like Butler, but Butler is really kind of unique in his use of analogy. A lot of people quote him and reference him, so that's why I'm including him in the course. The next thinker I want to share with you is William Paley. at the bottom of 46. William Paley, like Butler, is a Christian apologist, and he focuses on the teleological argument. You remember Thomas Aquinas says that when unintelligent things act for an end or act for a purpose, it must be because an intelligent being has made them act for a purpose. And what Paley does is to come up with a lot of illustrations of this. He is the one who said that if you find a stone in the field, you suppose that it must have been there for centuries, but if you find a watch, you never suppose that. Rather, you find in the watch evidence of intelligent design. So Paley appeals to the way we think about in every other sphere, you know, the way we think in other areas of life. And he argues, and I think this is fairly plausible, that we ought to reason that way in religion too, that when we look at the world and we find evidences of intelligent design, we ought to assume that there's been a designer, that somebody has made it that way. So he points out many examples of design in nature, lots of means that are adapted to ends, and things like the human eye, you know, all the little parts of the human eye that work together so precisely. How could that just happen? Well, Paley wasn't aware of the theory of evolution, but the theory of evolution says that these things all happen for survival and by way of mutations. But it still boggles the mind. I mean, what survival value does a retina have if you don't have the cornea, you know? What survival value do all these little parts have if they're not working together as a totality? But then that would mean that the totality had to spring into existence all of a sudden, which no evolutionist would claim. So I think the teleological argument is a pretty strong argument here. Hume replies that given infinite time, anything can happen by chance. But Paley says, think about this the way you think of everything else. When you see the watch in the field, you don't say, well, given infinite time, this watch could have appeared by chance. No, you use your common sense, and again, this is kind of pragmatic, this is kind of practical reasoning. You know, the best explanation of that watch being there is that somebody designed the watch, and somebody wore the watch, and somebody lost the watch there in the field, and it's all a matter of intelligent design. And why shouldn't we think that way when we're looking at the world? Don't be taken aside by the bare possibility that over billions of years it might have happened by chance. We never reason like that in any other area of life, so why should we reason like that in the area of religion? A uniform design is present in all these evidences, so there is one designer. David Hume speculated that maybe there are lots of different designers, one designer for the eye and another designer for the intestines and another design for the moon and the stars and so on and so forth. But Paley goes to some lengths to try to show that all of these things, all the different systems in the world are made to work together. Now, who was it that coordinated all those things? So that points to one designer. He also uses the cosmological argument. Again, he comes up with a neat illustration. He says, look, let's say you have a chain, and there's a weight that hangs from the chain. So you say that this weight is being held up by this link. This link is being held up by this link, and this link is being held up by that link. And on and on and on you go. What is it that actually holds up the weight? Well, it's the whole chain, but how long is that chain? And what's at the other end of the chain? Does the chain just go on to infinity? Well, you know, the chain can't hold the weight, even if it's, you know, 1,000 links long, even if it's 1,000,000,000 links long, even if it's 1,000,000 links long, even if it's infinitely long, it won't hold up the weight. So there must be something at the top of that chain that explains why the chain works as it does. Miracles, Paley argues against Hume's disparagement of miracles. He says the witnesses can be trusted. See, Hume's argument is all about testimony, and Paley says you can trust the witnesses to the miracles because they maintain their witness even to death. Hume says universal experience testifies against miracle. Paley says, Hume, you're begging the question. So I'm just giving you the barest summary of Paley's work. Paley wrote huge volumes on this. He wrote a big text called Natural Theology. It's available now. I got an advertisement for it by email the other day. Might be worth your while to take a close look at it. The next thinker I'd like to look at, again, a Christian thinker, although Christianity doesn't play a profound role in his system, but his name is Thomas Reed, and you see his dates there on page 47. Thomas Reed is becoming known as a very important figure. When I majored in philosophy at Princeton between 1957 and 1961, they never mentioned Thomas Reed. Now, that was kind of unusual because that was kind of surprising because Reed was in the 19th century. Reed was a very fundamental influence at both Princeton University and Princeton Theological Seminary, which are two different institutions. So by the time I came there, in the middle of the 20th century, Reed was nearly forgotten. But over the last 30, 40 years, some philosophers, particularly Christian philosophers like Alvin Plantinga and Nicholas Woltersdorf, have rediscovered Thomas Reed and have made quite a bit of use of his ideas in Christian apologetics. And so today you hear about Thomas Reed all the time. He's a very important figure. Who is he? Well, he's a Scottish Presbyterian minister. He wasn't the founder of the Scottish Common Sense Realist School of Philosophy, but he came to be the dominant figure in that school, and you see some of the other names in that school. That philosophy, Scottish Common Sense Realism, came to dominate the teaching of Princeton University and Princeton Theological Seminary through the 1800s. Reed's thought was eclipsed in the 20th century, but rediscovered by many people, and today his influence is great. He begins by talking about, well, I don't know how he begins, but this is my analysis, this is my retelling of Reed's story. He talks about the faculties of the human mind, what the mind is able to do. Alvin Plantinga calls this our epistemic equipment, the things that we have in our mind that we're able to, that enable us to know things. And of course, obviously, the brain would be the physical basis of all of this. But all these terms like the intellect and the will and the senses and the reason and so on and so forth are epistemic equipment. And Reed says the mind has innate powers. Now, he doesn't say that the mind has innate ideas. He says the mind has innate powers. The mind is able to do things. And one thing that the mind is able to do is that it gives rise to concepts of qualities, of sensed objects. See, it's not just pure sense experience. It's not lox tabula rasa. It's not that the world just sends these sense data and bombard you with data from outside. No, the mind is working. The mind appropriates these things like Aristotle's active intellect. The mind takes these things in, and when the mind interacts with the senses, the mind forms concepts, the concept of the table, the concept of the tree, the concept of the person. These concepts are not reducible to sensations, as in Hume's philosophy. Concepts have objects. Concepts are of things. So my concept, I have a concept of the table. I have a concept of the tree. I have a concept of clocks. I have a concept of this clock. Concepts have objects. This is really, Reed was way ahead of his time here. This is sounding a little bit like the phenomenologists of the 20th century, which we'll talk about later on. And this process, the way the mind is working here, creates convictions. How do I gain a conviction? How do I gain a belief? How do I believe that the book is on the table? Well, I have a sense experience of that book being on the table, but my mind has categorized that sense experience. That is a book. My mind has a concept of the book, and my mind has a concept of the table. And when I bring all that together, then I get the belief, the justified belief, that the book is on the table. Well, why should we trust these faculties? Why should we trust the workings of the mind? Why should I trust my epistemic equipment? Well, I have to. There's no other way to live. You can call it a pragmatic justification if you want, but I need to trust my mind if I'm going to get along in the world, okay? It can't be like Parmenides and say that the world is totally different from what my reason dictates, and so I should live according to reason and forget what I see. Can't do that. You got to live in the world where you live, all right? So you trust your senses, and you trust your brain, and you trust the interaction between those to create beliefs. Elsewhere, lost in skepticism. And our faculties provide us with first principles, all right? And not only concepts of books and tables and so on, but also first principles, that is rules, or rules of thought, or assumptions, general assumptions that we should have about our thinking and about our living. These are common sense assumptions that are accepted by people in everyday conversation and business. For example, it's good to trust your memory. That's a common sense view. That's a common sense principle. Our memory is not infallible. Memory can make wrong judgments, but you gotta trust your memory for the most part, or else you can't live, right? So that's just common sense. I mean, you can't say, I remember that I came into this room at 9 o'clock, but maybe my memory is wrong. Maybe I was really at Disneyland. Well, it's barely possible, but I got to trust my memory, or I won't know what I'm here for, okay? Top of 46, these common sense principles cannot be justified by Cartesian arguments, that is, deducing them from self-evident premises, nor can they be justified by reducing them to sensation. Hume said in order to test an idea, you have to find out what sense impression it comes from. I can't do that. I mean, principle, you ought to trust your memory. That doesn't come from any particular sensation. But your common sense beliefs don't need that kind of justification. You may accept those beliefs without being able to justify them, without even being able to show why they belong to common sense. They do display some marks by which they can be recognized. Early appearance of its operation. As long as I can remember, I've trusted my memory. That sounds a little peculiar. But even when I was 4 years old, I was trusting my memory, right? Universality in mankind. I don't know anybody who doesn't trust their memory, right? I mean, you get some science fiction things, people who lose their short-term memory. And what was that movie when the guy was lost his short-term memory every day, and so he wrote notes to himself on his arm so that he would remember something the next day? That doesn't happen very often. Most people have pretty good memories, and most people trust their memories. And then irresistibility, that is, these common sense ideas force their ascent on you. You may try not to trust your memory. You might try to consider the possibility that I was at Disneyland at 9 o'clock this morning, but you can't really persuade yourself of that. And what you really believe is what your memory tells you. And what I really believe is that I came into this room around 9 o'clock this morning. So one of those principles is that you really ought to trust your memory. What are some others? Number three, the reliability of consciousness in showing us what exists. When I see a book on the table, my consciousness tells me that there's a book on the table. It tells me what is. It's reliable. Can't absolutely prove that, but I got to rely on that as a common sense assumption. B, conscious thoughts reveal a self-mind or person. David Hume looked around the world and said, hey, you know, I have sensations of animals and trees and so on, but I can't see the mind, I can't see the self. Well, says Reed, when I'm thinking, I know that I'm thinking. I mean, he's a Cartesian at that point. I can't doubt that I'm a self. I can't doubt that I have a mind. I can't doubt that I'm a person. C, the reliability of memory, as I said. D, personal identity continues through the course of remembered events. What I remember when I was 6 years old, I went to the first grade. Well, I'm the same person now that I was then. Personal identity. E, the general reliability of sense perception. This is not a pure empiricism where sense perception becomes the absolute criterion of truth. It's just general reliability of sense perception. Senses, of course, make mistakes from time to time, but we can generally rely on them. F, we have free will. Aha. Reed is trying to sneak that past us. Even though he's a Presbyterian, he believes in libertarian free will, autexousion. And one of the things that people say about free will is that you can prove it because you experience it. You can prove it because you can make changes. I can, you make choices. I can choose whether to lift up my arm or whether to leave it down. And so that proves that I have free will. No, it doesn't. Okay. Because if you try to prove free will that way, you need to prove an awful lot. You need to prove that there is no cause for my lifting my hand and putting it down. And you can't prove that by a feeling. Really, the feeling of choice doesn't prove anything. I mean, the feeling of choice just means that you've made a choice. It doesn't say anything about whether there's a cause, whether there's a physical cause or a divine cause or anything like that. It just says I've made a choice. So Reed, he believes in free will, and he tries to sneak that in here as a presupposition, as a common sense assumption, and I'm not going to let him do that. I'm sorry. G, the general reliability of all natural faculties. That would be our reason, what we call our reason. H, the assumption that others have life and intelligence. Now, here I am lecturing and there are no students, but if there were students here, I would have the belief that those other students have minds like I do, okay? That they have intelligence like I do. Now, it's just barely possible that they're all robots, okay? Maybe those of you who are listening online, there's a possibility that you're a robot, that you're not a real person, that you don't have a real mind. And that's a great old philosophical problem. We call it the problem of other minds. How do you prove that other people have minds like me? That's very difficult to do. You can't do it. Problem of other minds. Alvin Plantinga wrote a book called God and Other Minds, and he says, well, if there's justification for believing that other people have minds, there's similar justification for believing in God. Hey, that's kind of like a Butler's analogy, isn't it? But getting back to this, what Reed says is you just have to assume that other people have minds like you, or else you can't really live in the world. This is a common sense assumption. Now you can bring in some evidence. You can say that the words and actions of other people indicate like powers of understanding as we are conscious of in ourselves. But you can't prove that, you know. Science fiction indicates that it might be possible someday to have a very sophisticated robot that interacts with us. I don't know how many of you have seen the movie Prometheus, but there's a character there that's sort of like that, or like Data on Star Trek, or like HAL in 2001. Very sophisticated robots who are able to conduct human conversations and act like human beings. But, you know, you don't conclude. I mean, if I were to meet you on the street, I wouldn't say, now, wait a minute here, I got to prove that you're a human being like me. I got to prove that you're not a robot. We don't do that. We assume that other people are people like us. And that's the way to be, according to Reed. That's a common sense assumption, and we've got to live by that common sense assumption. Physical features and actions of people reveal their minds. J, regard is due to human testimony and authority. David Hume thought that testimony was basically worthless in a lot of cases. Reed says you gotta, you know, generally respect the testimony of other people and respect their authority. K, people's actions are more or less regular. People usually don't act out of character, so you can predict what somebody's going to do. L, the future will be like the past. That's another famous philosophical problem, the problem of induction. You know, we believe in the law of gravitation, but how do we know that it'll be in effect tomorrow? You know, maybe tomorrow everything that goes up, everything that goes down will come up. So what are we going to do? Well, we have to assume certain things. We have to accept our limitations. We have to go on common sense. Well, under D, I have some comments here. Again, Reed is not exactly an empiricist, but there is a significant role for sense experience in Reed's thought. We are kind of especially interested, though, in number two, Reed's relationship to Christian theism. Reed, remember, is a Presbyterian minister, and he's true to his Presbyterian theology in regarding the faculties of the mind as divinely implanted and therefore trustworthy. Now, how is God known? Well, we said under the list of common sense beliefs, others have life and intelligence. We conclude God's existence by means of an argument based on his actions and his effects. We should remember that Reed, you might expect that Reed would make belief in God a common sense principle. He doesn't. Alvin Plantinga does. That's one area where he thinks he's improved on Reed. But Reed doesn't make the existence of God a foundational principle, what he says is that we come to know God through an argument based on God's actions and effects. That argument is dependent on a common sense assumption, but the existence of God is not itself a common sense assumption. Section C, Reed does not recognize any dependence of our faculties, evidence, arguments upon divine revelation. And that's the main problem with Reed as I see it. He doesn't have any role for divine revelation in human epistemology. He bases it entirely on these common sense beliefs which we have. But are we to believe God? And what if God contradicts my memory? What if God contradicts my beliefs about other people? What role does that play in the formation of my beliefs? Reed here doesn't say what I think a Christian philosopher ought to say. And so even though he's a believer, I have no reason to doubt that, his reasoning here is not distinguishable from autonomous reasoning. And there is, I think, a certain arbitrariness in Reed's approach. He seems to be saying that if there is something we all want to believe but we can't prove it, we can make it a first principle. The critics of Van Til sometimes joke around that his principle is when in doubt, presuppose. I think that's a caricature, and I don't think that that's an accurate presentation of Van Til. But there's something kind of similar going on here in Reed. Reed takes all these things that philosophers have argued about for centuries, the problem of induction, the problem of other minds, and all of that, and he says, look, let's just make an assumption. Let's just make a common sense assumption and then forget about the argument. And, you know, there are a lot of things that I would like very much to believe. and do I have the right then to say that my answer is justified by common sense? Well, most people would say no. As I say, Reed is now, today, recognized as a very important thinker. And we find that in Plantinga, we find that in others. Also in the so-called classical apologetics of R.C. Sproul, William Lane Craig, John Gerstner. What Sproul and Gerstner say in their book Classical Apologetics is something like this, that we must trust our senses and our reason, kind of along Reed's lines. These are common sense beliefs, we can't live without them. But they have no meaning unless God exists, so we need to believe in God as the ground of these faculties. This argument is very Reedian. It also seems to me to be very similar to what Van Til calls the transcendental argument, that you can't proceed on these common sense beliefs unless God exists. So maybe the differences between the different schools of apologetics are not so different as we sometimes think.
The preceding program has been brought to you by RTS on iTunes U and may not be reproduced or disseminated in part or in whole, for sale or for profit, without express written consent. For more information on RTS degrees and programs, please visit us at www.rts.edu or call 1-855-854-6920.